I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital provides cardiac care for the poor in India, and Dr. Shetty started the hospital in 2001. Welcome, Dr. Shetty.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
I'm speaking with you over the phone. You are currently in your home in India. Could you explain in your own words what Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital does?
The idea is to bring cardiac surgery to everyone. My country requires 2.5 million heart surgeries a year. And currently, we are all the heart hospitals in the country put together only doing about 90,000 heart surgeries. Jessica, first heart surgery was done 100 years ago. 100 years later, only 8% of the world's population can afford heart operation. Something has to be done. Narayana Hrudayalaya Heart Hospital has 1,000 beds, and we have 24 operation theaters. The infrastructure is currently performing about 30 major heart surgeries a day, but that is half of our capacity. And about 30% of our workload is on children coming from 65 countries for heart operation. And about 60% to 70% of the work is adult cardiac surgery.
What is the cost of open heart surgery to somebody who could afford it in India?
Approximately a heart operation on a child who can't afford to pay for the operation would cost about $1,400. The same operation in the U.S. might cost you around $200,000.
What are the primary factors in the business model of low-cost heart surgery? How are you managing to provide low-cost care to India's poor population?
First thing is you have to build a hospital differently. If you build a 100-bed, 200-bed hospital, you cannot reduce the cost. Because in a hospital, bulk of the cost goes for a hard infrastructure like blood bank, laboratories, CT scans, MRIs, PET scans. These are very, very expensive instruments. And what we do is we buy all these advanced machines, but we use them for 24 hours. To run it for 24 hours, you need a large number of outpatients. Large number of outpatients will come, provided you are affordable. So first thing is we build hospitals in about 15 to 25 acres of land. And then we plan to build 5,000 beds, which we build in phases. So if you have large number of beds, then you do more operations. As you do more operations, your results get better. As your results get better, your cost also goes down. And because of these two reasons, more people will come to you.
What were you doing prior to opening the hospital?
I graduated from a medical college called Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, Mangalore in India. Then, like most Indian doctors, I went to England for training in cardiac surgery. Then I came back to Calcutta. I was one of the first few heart surgeons to come back to India to set up cardiac surgical unit. It was in 1989, where cardiac surgery was a mystery to most of my citizens. And when I started my career in Calcutta, if I saw 100 patients per day, not even one person could afford the heart operation. Then I realized that unless I take care of the ability to pay or the paying capacity of the patient, I wouldn't have a practice. So this is how everything started.
You conducted surgery on Mother Teresa. How was that a turning point for you, if at all?
Meeting Mother, as a scientist, I would never accept another human being with flesh and blood like me as God. But I can tell you that Mother was truly God in human form. Being with her, interacting with her, maybe as a heart surgeon treating her, it was a turning point in my career. Her simplicity, her approach towards the realities of life, it made a tremendous impact. And she gave me the fantastic definition of the definition for a pediatric cardiac surgeon. One day I was going for rounds and she was following me, even though she was an inpatient. She looked at the kids I operated. Then she looked at my eyes and she said, "Doc, I know why you're here." I said, "Why, mother, why am I here?" He said, "When God made these children with the heart disease, he was probably preoccupied. Then he realized there was a problem and he sent you to fix it." And that is the best definition one could give for a pediatric cardiac surgeon.
How religious were you prior to meeting Mother Teresa?
I was always religious, no doubt, undoubtedly. I was born and brought up in a typical Hindu family down south, where religion is part of our life. But she reinforced my belief in God. She convinced me that the best way to serve God is by serving mankind. So I still have a poster of Mother Teresa in my office, which says, "Hands which help are better than the lips that pray."
And Narayana Rudayalaya, the name of your hospital, means God's compassionate home.
Essentially, in India, primarily we revolve our life around God and the cosmic forces. We wanted to create something unique, something big, which would make a difference to the society. Rudaya is heart. Alaya is temple.
We talk about Mother Teresa having this seminal impact on you, but was the train on the tracks to create this hospital even prior to your meeting her?
I think I was in the process of thinking about doing something different, something big. And this interaction with Mother, which lasted for close to 5 years, definitely had an impact on where I wanted to reach. Definitely it had a big impact in terms of looking after the underprivileged are the main concern and the pivotal role it had in building this institution.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Now, the institution or the hospital is in Bangalore, India, and Bangalore is known as sort of the Silicon Valley of India, where there's a lot of technical innovation. Why did you choose to locate the hospital in Bangalore? Was it accidental or was it purposeful?
My wife is from Bangalore. That is one of the main attractions to come back to Bangalore. But, you know, it's a coincidence that Bangalore happens to be the Silicon Valley, and so many exciting developments are happening in Bangalore. That definitely helped our objective. But the decision to come back to Bangalore was coming back home.
You mentioned your wife, and it was your in-laws who funded the project. What did your mother or father-in-law do that enabled them to have enough capital to fund the hospital?
My father-in-law was running a very successful construction company, in fact, around 20 years ago. So towards the end of his professional life, he wanted to build a hospital to make a difference to the society. But he had only one condition, a condition that we should never refuse any child who comes to us with a heart disease, irrespective of caste, creed, and nationality. And this is something which he firmly believed, and he insisted that we do it. That's the only condition he had. And we carried on, and this is how the whole thing started.
It seems, Dr. Shetty, that there was this real kind of perfect intersection of Mother Teresa and your medical expertise and your father-in-law all coming together to create this hospital. Do you ever think about that, kind of the stars aligning?
You're right. I strongly believe in that, Jessica. I strongly believe in cosmic forces. Long, long ago, Jessica, I received a donation of 100,000 rupees from one of the army soldiers from Madras. He refused to give his name, and he wrote one note saying that the path you have chosen, the amount of money I am giving is too small, but God has his own mysterious ways of doing the rest. This is exactly what happened in my life. These are all strange coincidences at every level of my life. But I strongly believe that there is somebody up there with the proper design, which is a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps happening all the time.
So you decide to launch this initiative in Bangalore. How did you get the land to build this vast health campus?
Our country is made up of 32 states. And these states have chief ministers and the government. And these governments are very supportive of hospital projects by people like us. So we get land virtually free, or we get land for a token amount of money, because government wants this type of large initiatives to come up.
Your hospital is performing roughly 7,000 surgeries a year, and often your doctors are being paid less than doctors elsewhere in the country. How is morale among your doctors?
We have zero attrition rate. No doctor has ever left us. I guess there is not even only one person left in the last 15 years for family reasons. Now, why people stick around, even though their salary is not up to the level what they can get elsewhere, is because as surgeons, if you want to attract them, they need much more than money. They want to do something else. And we always provide what they want, because I am one among them. Every day, children come to us. You know, typically a newborn baby who's very, very blue comes to you. We look at the kid. We tell the mother, baby requires operation. The baby goes to the OT, comes back to the ICU, and we call the mother to see the baby after 4 hours. Mother looks at the baby and say, look, this is not my child. Then we say, that is your child. Then the mother says, look, he was dark. He was black before you did the operation. Then we tell her that, yeah, he was dark, but now he's pink. Then she will touch the baby, and then she will look at our eyes and say, will he always remain like this? Then we say, yeah, he's going to remain like that. So in a matter of 5 hours, we have transformed the lives of these people. So this is something which you can never buy, irrespective of what money, you know, what you're prepared to trade.
You mentioned before that 30% of the surgeries that you conduct in your hospital is for babies or pediatric care. Why is it so high? Is it larger in India than in other countries?
Jessica, you remember, we produce 28 million babies a year. We produce the largest number of babies in the world. One out of 140 children born anywhere in the world has heart disease. That means technically we produce about 600 to 1,000 children a day with heart disease. And someone has to fix their heart, because these children, if they are operated the moment they are born or in the first few months of their life, you can cure them. So someone has to do it. So we are privileged to be that someone to fix these children's heart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a medical entrepreneur who is creating a new healthcare economic model in India by providing affordable cardiac care for India's poor population. We'll hear more from Dr. Devi Shetty coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the medical entrepreneur Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Over 7,000 surgeries take place in his Nayanarayana Hrudayalaya Hospital, located in Bangalore, India. Dr. Shetty founded the hospital in 2001. Now, you offer a form of insurance called Yashasvini. Can you talk a little bit about the germ of the idea for providing insurance?
The Karnataka Milk Federation, which is a conglomeration of milk producers, they requested me to sponsor one of their low-fat milk, claiming that it's good for the heart. And I agreed to endorse their product, provided the Milk Federation agrees to offer health insurance to the people who sell milk. So they agreed to do that. This is how we started the micro health insurance for the people, farmers who sell milk. And it started with a premium of 11 cents per month. We kept the premium at 11 cents because that is the price of local cigarette called BD they smoke. So the idea was to promote this concept that instead of smoking BD, you buy a health insurance and you will be protected for major illnesses. Today it has grown. This insurance has now spread to other states of the country. Everywhere, 60%, 80% of state population is covered by the health insurance.
So this health insurance that you offer started with this milk cooperative, essentially this group of farmers who, as you say, pay 11 cents a month for insurance. Can you talk a little bit about the rural poor? I mean, your hospital is in Bangalore, in a major city, but how are you addressing the needs of the rural poor who can't be transported to the hospital in time if they're having a heart attack, for example?
First thing is, when they develop heart attack, we look after their heart attack from remote areas, from the satellite. We have, you know, Jessica, there are 5 countries in the world which can put satellite on the space, and India is one of those countries. And we have been chosen to be partners with the Indian Space Research Organization to help them to monitor the astronauts when India eventually puts the man on the moon. And we have satellite connection free of cost. So we put up these satellite collection in remote government hospitals and manage heart attack and heart failure sitting in Bangalore or Calcutta. And till date, we have treated over 53,000 heart patients in remote locations.
Can you walk me through, let's say Devi the farmer is having a heart attack or is having some heart trouble. Can you walk me through what happens to him?
Yeah, let's put it this way. A farmer in Hubli, which is about 300 kilometers from Bangalore, if he develops a heart attack, he will go to a general practitioner with chest pain. And most general practitioners down south has a ECG machine, which is linked to the telephone line. And as soon as he does the ECG, it comes to our hospital. And in less than 5 minutes, we give the report to the telephone line. And if it is diagnosed as heart attack, we ask them to go to a coronary care unit in a government hospital or one of our satellite units over there. So the preliminary care is taken care of. That will save about 95% of the victims of heart attack. And after about 1 month, they will come to Bangalore for further evaluation. And there we do the angiogram and, if required, operation.
You mentioned the Indian Space Research Organization that helps you use satellites for this cardiac care. Whose idea was it to use this space research organization?
The Indian Space Research Organization, they wanted us to help them in monitoring the vitals of astronauts. So we are helping them in their project, and they help us to give the satellite connections free of cost. Right now, sitting in Bangalore, we treat patients in 56 cities of Africa where our satellites are beamed. But the exciting thing, Jessica, I'll tell you, when we do liver transplants on children in Bangalore, do you know who gives the anesthesia for the kids? The anesthesia is given by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in America.
Wait, so can you explain that to me, how a hospital in Philadelphia is helping you with a liver transplant in Bangalore?
We have extremely skilled surgeons who can do the liver transplant. But our anesthetists are cardiac anesthetists. They do not know the details about managing very sick child who is undergoing a liver transplant, where the operation lasts for 10 hours, 12 hours. So we tied up with Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The anesthetists there, they realize that since we have the satellite link up, they can sit in the operating room of Philadelphia and manage the anesthesia of the kid who's undergoing operation in Bangalore. Other than touching, they can do everything.
So we talk about, Dr. Shetty, you're creating a health city, but it sounds, with this example of the connection with Philadelphia and also serving African patients, that essentially you're creating a health world.
Trying to, Jessica.
My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital started off serving cardiac care for India's poor, and now its health centers help patients who have heart problems, eye problems, arthropedic issues, and cancer as well. Could you provide some anecdotes to help us understand what you do on a daily basis?
I start my work very early in the morning. Generally, my colleagues start the surgery at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I reach the hospital by around 7:30. Then I have to see at least 70 to 100 patients every day in the outpatients. That's the time patients come, they talk to me about their problems, I console them, try to organize financial assistance. And the, essentially, it's like a meeting area for the patients. I spend about 5 hours with the patients. Then around 12 o'clock, I start the surgery. And I generally concentrate on operations called pulmonary endarterectomies or aneurysms. This is my area of interest. And sometimes I operate on newborn babies. Then as soon as I finish the operation, then maybe half an hour or an hour with my team discussing about various strategies and management issues. Then again, the outpatient. And then it's around 9:30, 10 o'clock. That's the time to go home.
You mentioned you see 70 to 100 patients per day in a span of 5 hours?
Yes. I generally try to spend about 2 to 3 minutes with each patient. Everything has been done by my colleagues. The diagnosis is made, the planning was made, everything is done. But most of these people, unless I see them and unless I touch them, they wouldn't like to go for the operation. Mm. So it is essentially getting to know the family and explain to them that this is what we are planning to do. It is just reassurance that I am there to help them. I try to see at least in 5 minutes about 2 patients. Mm-hmm. I have a very big clock hung in front of the wall so that I'm constantly reminded. And I have a very fancy chair made by Herman Miller, which can move from one end of the table to the other end like a Ziffy. So I can turn my chair on and off and, you know, facing one patient, and the second minute I'm facing another patient.
Incidentally, was the Herman Miller chair donated?
That's a good question. It is actually gifted by my son. When he graduated, I guess he earned some money, and he was looking at me struggling with the old Indian chair where the wheels used to get stuck up. You see, what happens when I talk to a patient, the first 2 minutes is about talking to the patient, getting to, you know, convincing them about the treatment and all that. Then they are happy with the treatment. Then they start talking about, you know, I operated on their uncle or a father or a grandfather, how well he is or how grateful I am and all that. That's the time I try to move my chair to the other side of the table. Mm. And I need very good wheels. And my son realized that Herman Miller is the best chair.
So really what you're giving to these, you know, 100 patients is emotional consultation versus medical consultation.
Perfect. Yeah, you got it right, Jessica.
Do you worry at all that there's this kind of Walmartization of healthcare? In order for your hospital or for your low-cost health plan to work, you really have to serve many, many, many patients. You know, as you say, you're seeing 100 patients a day. You're doing 2 operations a day. This is obviously far more than the international average. Do you ever worry about the optics of that?
Not really. In the sense, see, there are a lot of changes happening in the country. Now, people, when they come to us, they're a lot more knowledgeable about what we are doing in the heart operation. So they have less questions. They are mentally prepared when they come. And also, my team is growing. So I'm surrounded by physician assistants and well-trained doctors. So essentially, I wouldn't say that as the workload goes up, we lose touch with the patients and the emotional aspect of it. I don't think it will happen. Mm. I think it's only getting better as the time passed by.
You talk about being at work around 7 in the morning and going home around 10 at night. What does your wife think about this?
She was finding it. She comes from a very rich family. So, she was initially a bit disappointed. But then, you know, as the family grew, now my children are grown up. My oldest son is an engineer. He's building all the hospitals. And my second son is a doctor, third son is in the medical school. She kind of likes my profession, even though she doesn't admit. all along she cursed my profession. But when my oldest son decided to become an engineer, and one day he declared that, "Daddy, I want to become an engineer." I said, "All right, that's good." Then she just, the hell broke loose. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "Why he doesn't want to become a doctor?" Then I said, "All along you have been cursing my profession, and you're disappointed your son doesn't want to become a doctor." That's the time I realized maybe my wife likes my profession.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Dr. Shetty, your public health initiative has been quite successful against many odds. Could you talk about some of those odds or hurdles that you had to jump over in order to provide low-cost health care to the poor population in India?
When I started my career, the greatest difficulty was convincing people to undergo the operation. The heart surgery was in an infantile stage. Then once I accomplished it, the problem was the affordability.
You have this vision of having 30,000 beds in your health center. What are the hurdles to making that happen? Are they financial? Are they getting people's imaginations to understand what that means? What are those hurdles?
See, the first thing is we strongly believe that India will become the first country in the world to dissociate healthcare from affluence, healthcare from your bank balance. If there is one country in the world which can do it, that is India, because we produce the largest number of doctors, nurses, and medical technicians in the world. We have the largest number of US FDA-approved drug manufacturing units outside USA. We have everything required for a fantastic healthcare delivery system. But there is something which can prevent this from happening, that is lack of adequate beds. That is the reason why we want to create these 30,000 beds. Our biggest stumbling block now is arranging funds at our terms to roll out this many beds in a short duration of time without really losing control of the organization. This has been the challenge, because regular financial mechanisms will not be able to help us. So the challenge is raising equity, raising money for all this massive scale expansion.
What is your annual budget?
I guess around $100 to $120 million.
Per year. Yeah. It costs about $200,000 for a patient in the United States to have open heart surgery. And you are building a center or a hospital, cardiac care center, in the Cayman Islands so that United States citizens and those nearby could benefit from low-cost surgery. Why does it cost $200,000 in the U.S.?
I think in the U.S., the cost structure is radically different. You see, we work for 6 days in a week, whereas in the U.S., it's only 5 days in a week. Plus, your nurses and doctors generally work for 48 hours in a week, whereas we work virtually double the number of hours. So in U.S. hospitals, traditionally 65% of the revenue goes for the salaries, while in Indian hospitals it's about 20%. So essentially the cost structure, the litigation, the malpractice suits, these are all issues which would jack up the price. And also there is large insurance companies, you know, with their own, agenda. So essentially, it is a business where there are too many people with too many rigid rules and regulations, and there is absolutely no scope for innovation in the process of delivery. You just cannot innovate.
Hopefully, now that you'll be setting up a center in the Cayman Islands, some competition will cause the U.S. to get their butts in gear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think I would like to compete with the American hospitals. I just want to show our modest way of doing things.
You mentioned malpractice and lawsuits in the United States. How common are medical malpractice lawsuits in India?
It's extremely small. Primarily because as surgeons, we spend a lot of time with the patient before operation. We make things very clear to the family. So they don't have unrealistic expectations.
Doctor, you've changed so many people's lives. You've improved so many people's lives by providing low-cost cardiac care. Is there a story or two that come to your mind to demonstrate this?
See, essentially, I am like anybody else in the patient community because as a kid, I am the eighth child of a family with nine children. So when I grew up, my parents were old. My vivid memories about my father is an elderly person who goes in and out of the hospital because of diabetes complications. So in my life, doctors remained as very important people, and this may be one of the reasons why I decided to become a doctor. So when I interact with the patients, when I see a young lady with a young husband undergoing heart operation with young children, when I operate on them, I think about my life. In case my father had an operation, needed an operation when he was young, and if something happened to him, we would all be on the street. So, you know, these patients' lives are no different than our life. I guess this is one of the greatest motivating factors for all of us to do our best to save their life.
Well, Dr. Shetty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. It was a great experience talking to you because you are the first Western interviewer who could pronounce the name of my hospital.
My guest has been Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Coming up, we'll meet Ron Gonin, co-founder of Recycle Bank, a recycling business. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Ron Gonin, co-founder of Recycle Bank, a company that rewards households for recycling. Ron started Recycle Bank in 2004, and the program operates in over 300 municipalities across the United States and the United Kingdom. Some of the cities in partnership with Recycle Bank include Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Houston. Recycle Bank gives credits based on the weight of people's recyclable materials, and these credits get converted to points that can be used at businesses like Whole Foods and Home Depot. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How exactly does Recycle Bank work?
Recycle Bank signs long-term contracts with cities. Every home gets one of our recycling containers. It has a chip embedded in it. We retrofit the city's trucks with a mechanical arm that picks up the container, reads the chip, identifies that your home recycled and how much your home recycled. That amount is translated into points called Recycle Bank points, and you can use those points to shop at over 1,000 different businesses. You can earn up to about $250 a year.
What incentive do cities have to participate?
Recycling actually saves their city a tremendous amount of money. The actual financial value of recycling is not how much you can sell it for, but the cost avoidance of not having to send it to a landfill.
So take New York City, for example. What is the cost for New York City to send trash to a landfill? What's involved?
New York City, I think, today spends about $100 a ton for disposal, and it generates over 5 million tons of waste a year. You're looking at about $1 billion disposal budget for the city of New York. So it's a significant cost to a city to dispose of waste in landfills. And that should really be the focus of recycling.
So describe the state of landfills. They're kind of out of sight, out of mind a little bit.
Right. The fact that they're out of sight, out of mind is actually is what makes them so expensive is people generate garbage in their city or their town, but nobody wants to live next to the landfill. And so the landfills are actually very, very far away generally, which is what makes disposal in landfills expensive. You have to drive long distances every day to dispose of the waste in landfill. But the state of landfills is that the space in landfills is shrinking, and the amount of garbage that's being created is increasing. and it's difficult to increase supply because it's difficult to get permits for landfills, while demand, the need to dispose of the waste, is increasing.
You were born in the 1970s. When did you first learn about recycling?
I was always very socially minded. I was fortunate to be able to go to a private school on a financial aid package and athletic scholarship. And my mother always stressed how lucky I was to have this opportunity, how important it was to give back. But recycling specifically, we used to have plastic silverware in my high school. And a teacher came up to me, and it's interesting that I think back now that he came up to me. I think at the time I was president of student government. Maybe that's why he came up to me. Maybe there was something he saw in my future. But he came up to me and said, you know, it's not environmentally friendly for us to be using plastic as silverware. I think you should look into trying to use silverware. And I remember he just kind of whispered it to me. And thinking back on it now, it's kind of funny because it struck something in me. And my first sort of environmental initiative was to get rid of all the plastic utensils and turn it into silverware. And that's really how I got started.
You talk about going to private school. That was in Philadelphia, but you spend the first 6 or 7 years in Israel.
Yeah. My father's Israeli, and he had come over to the United States for medical school and met my mother, and they moved back to Israel. And when my parents divorced, I came back here to the United States, and I would go to school in the United States and then go back to Israel for the summers. And so at 6, 7, 8 years old, my mother would take me to JFK Airport, and I'd get on a plane. And it's funny to think back now, but I guess you could do this in, you know, 1980, 81. And I would get on a plane by myself, and I'd get off the plane in Israel, and my father was waiting there for me.
You graduated from Columbia Business School, and you started Recycle Bank fresh out of business school. You had a partner at the time, Patrick Fitzgerald. How did you come up with the idea?
Patrick and I had dinner one night, and he said, would it be possible to reward people for recycling? I said, I think I can develop a business model to do that.
How did you know Patrick?
We went to high school together.
And did he stay with the company? Or?
No, he ended up leaving in 2006.
How come?
I think that we were growing rapidly, and he had an opportunity to get a financial exit at that time, and wasn't necessarily sure where he saw himself short or long term in the company, and made a personal decision that he wanted to exit and do other things. More often than not, from what I've heard, partnerships don't work out. I think the most important thing is, very early on, you talk about what it is you're trying to get out of the opportunity, kind of keep checking in with each other to make sure that that's still why you want to do this. And I don't think we did a good enough job of checking in with each other. I'm working 24/7 trying to build a business, and he's trying to figure out sort of his next step in life, and you sort of naturally drift apart. And he was really fortunate. He got to, you know, walk away with something that gave him financial freedom.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ron Gonin, co-founder of Recycle Bank, a company that rewards households for recycling. So you had this idea for Recycle Bank. Who did you raise capital from in the early days?
I first raised capital from myself. I took all of my savings and invested it in the company.
Are we talking $20,000 or $100,000?
I put about $35,000 of my savings mm-hmm. into it. And then I maxed out my credit card. And then I was fortunate to get Columbia University to invest in the business. Invested $100,000. And then I got a small recycling company in Philadelphia called Blue Mountain Recycling to invest. And they invested $200,000. And then there's a company called Cascade Engineering. And they make recycling carts. And I had secured a pilot program with the city of Philadelphia. And I had told them that we could do this pilot program, 5,000 homes. They were excited. We were excited. But I didn't have the capital for the 5,000 carts. It was about $250,000. So I was calling around cart manufacturers, telling them that if they would do a partnership with us where they supplied the carts and everything for the pilot project, I would buy carts from them. And nobody would go along with it. They all thought it was a great idea, but they didn't think it was possible. The person I spoke with at Cascade Engineering, Mark Broderick said, I don't see us doing this, but we have this great CEO who's very socially minded and really cares about the environment and loves to see innovation. Let me at least bring it up with him. And fortunately, Fred Keller, who's the CEO there, understood my vision, what I was trying to accomplish, and agreed to help us out. They gave us the carts in exchange for an agreement that we would buy carts from them in the future.
That was an early lucky moment to have a pilot project launched in the city of Philadelphia. What other turning points were there early on?
There was an article on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer about how if the city could get from a 5% recycling rate to a 35% recycling rate, they would save $17 million. The next day, I called the city. And they said, sure, come on in, let's have a meeting. I'm not sure if they would have been as receptive before that article. So that was a turning point. Everything I had been telling people about the economics of cities and recycling, and people sort of said, interesting, not sure that it's right, hit the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer. It sort of validated what I'd been out there saying. So that was a turning point. I had some really phenomenal people join me early on that were instrumental in helping me get the business launched. One of them was Bob Milligan, who sold his first company in 1975, the year I was born. Heard about what I was doing, saw that there was a paradigm shift, came to me and said, I can help you build this. I didn't have any money to really pay him at the time, but he just wanted to be a part of it. And he joined me, and he was instrumental because he gave me a lot of instruction about what's going on in the recycling industry, but a lot of validity in the recycling industry. Oftentimes I would go into meetings and Bob would come in with me and someone would say, Bob, I worked for you back in 1988. Mm-hmm. And he was instrumental as an advisor, as just a guy with a great work ethic and also the respect that people had for him.
How much capital did you end up raising ultimately?
$70 million for venture capital.
Now, this space has become very crowded, you know, clean tech, green energy. What was it about RecycleBank that you think drew in all these venture capitalists?
We had contracts. We were making money. And we had a pipeline of contracts. And that sounds simple and obvious for a business to get investment. But when I started RecycleBank in 2004 and was talking to venture capitalists, they looked at recycling as very unsexy, didn't really see the opportunity. They were excited about these large-scale capital-intensive projects that they were investing in that by 2017 were going to light up the state of California. And after a few years of investing in those companies and recognizing that there's going to be a lot of competition, a lot of changes, and a lot of regulatory roadblocks. And they kept reading about this company, RecycleBank, that was signing another contract and revenues were growing. They started to become more receptive. So we were pretty successful in getting a lot of interest after 2 years of having no interest. So I've been on both sides of the spectrum. I've been on the side of no one returning my calls to, you know, the phone ringing off the hook and people trying to get in.
You were moving at 80 miles an hour trying to launch this. Were there any specific moments when you said, God, you know, I think this thing is going to work?
So when we started RecycleBank, I was one of the people that used to deliver the carts. And as I was delivering the carts in Chestnut Hill, which is a section of Philadelphia, a father came out of his house and came up to me and said, are you the RecycleBank guy? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I have two twin daughters. And I told them whoever takes out the recycling can get the points and can use the points to shop wherever they want. And that's going to be their allowance. And now I've taken my twin daughters, who I could never take out, never get to take out the recycling and garbage. We're actually fighting over who's going to take out the recycling. And that was just something in my mind that said, wow, we're actually motivating people's behaviors. And then the other thing is I opened up my email and I saw a police report. And I thought to myself, oh, wow, what happened now? And apparently a senior citizen in Wilmington, Delaware, had gotten very into her RecycleBank points because she could use them at Rite Aid. And she was watching from the window. And when the sanitation worker went by, because she only had a few things in her recycling container because, you know, she's a senior citizen, she doesn't buy that much stuff, rather than use the mechanical arm to pick it up, he just picked it up with his arm and dumped it in the truck. But by doing that, he wasn't recording the fact that she recycled. And so she filed a police report against the city sanitation department that they had taken away her value and her RecycleBank points and that she wanted her points. And the city sent me the police report and said, figure out a way to credit this woman. And that was another signal that, hey, this is really going to work when people are starting to file police reports because they didn't get their credit for recycling.
You seem to have been, you know, relatively lucky. You launched the company, you're able to raise capital, you were able to get contracts with these cities. Operationally, things moved relatively smoothly. What was harder for you than you thought it would be?
The hardest part has been understanding the ramifications of raising money and who you raise it from and what impact that has on your business and your people. When you start raising money, you're giving pieces of your business away to people who may not share the social mission. And when you're a young entrepreneur and you're desperate for the cash, you don't take all those things into account.
So what's one example of something that might be compromised because the venture capitalist has one view, but you have a more socially minded view?
How you look at a contract. We sign 10-year contracts. And if someone has a 2 or 3 year investment horizon and is dealing with 20 investments that they've made, sometimes you may have someone around the table who they want to exit as soon as possible. And they're not really focused on how do we structure this deal for 10 years. It's how do we structure it to get maximum value right now. Oftentimes, people don't have that frank conversation up front because they're afraid that something they're going to say is going to kill the deal. Mm-hmm. And both parties are desperately trying to kind of want to get the deal done because the VC wants to get into the deal and the entrepreneur just wants to get the money and move on. And then sometime later, an issue comes up and everybody's shocked that the other person feels that way or would do something in that way. And that's something that's you have to manage.
You were married to Recycle Bank. You were the founder and CEO for a while. What implication did that have on your personal life?
So I think that the biggest thing that I would have done differently is I think I worked too hard in the sense that I started to lose perspective and balance in my own life. All I did was work on Recycle Bank. And you kind of get addicted and obsessed and you become really a workaholic. That's why I wanted a transition is I turned 35 and I was looking around and I was kind of like, you know, I'm still in the office at 7 a.m. I'm still in the office till 11 p.m. You know, we've built a really good, solid company that's making an important difference in the world. But I could very easily turn around and be 40 and still be in the office till 11 o'clock at night. And I've been doing this for the last 6 years. And I just had this moment late at night in the office where I felt like it's the right time to transition. And I got the feeling a little bit that some of my investors felt the same thing. Like, this guy's just working all the time. How do we get to that next step? And I had a really good conversation with Trey Vasallo, who's a partner over at Kleiner Perkins, one of our investors, and she was very matter of fact. She said, have you ever considered transitioning and bringing in another CEO? And I said, you know, I've been thinking about the same thing and started talking to people, and that's really how we got the transition going. But that's one thing I would have done differently is I would have found more personal balance.
What do you feel is lacking as a result of the personal balance? What do you feel you missed?
I was probably a very difficult person to date because I was working all the time and really focused on my business, and it had a big impact. That's part of why I transitioned, is I felt like I was turning 35 years old and I wanted to start a family. And I felt like just knowing my workaholism, you know, I like to think that I was a fun date, but I was probably a difficult boyfriend because I was working so much.
You keep saying I was probably a difficult boyfriend. Were you definitely a difficult boyfriend? Did people tell you were a difficult boyfriend?
Well, I was living with somebody at the time who was actually we're partners in another business now called Lennart Design, and I, you know, she and I talk a lot about that time because we lived together for part of that time, and I think part of her had a lot of admiration for how hard I was working and what I was building and the way I treated people.
But
it was also very difficult to be with somebody who, you know, gets home at 11 o'clock at night, can't fall asleep because they're worried about something, so they get out of bed and they go to the computer and they, you know, just keep working away. Or you go out with friends and, you know, you're on your BlackBerry or you're at a movie and you doze off. That's also very difficult from a personal level. So I think it comes with both things. I think it comes with part admiration, part, oh man, I wish they would just show me more attention and time.
And love.
yeah, and love.
So you mentioned Linhart Design, and Linhart Design is a jewelry company. What other projects do you have going on?
One other project I have going on is I'm working on a venture that's going to collect dog waste in New York City and turn it into electricity. So dog waste or any organic matter for that matter is actually a very rich energy source. And today we collect it in plastic bags and drive it down to a landfill in Pennsylvania. And so we're taking an energy source, and instead of using it, we're using energy to actually dispose of it in a hole. And so my idea is to actually collect the dog waste locally in New York City, take it to Central Park or Riverside Park, and use a methane digester to generate electricity.
Do you have a dog?
I don't. I used to.
How'd you come up with the idea?
A lot of my life experience is walking around the streets and seeing the way things are. And when I see something that doesn't seem to be working right, I try and come up with a solution for it. I know a decent amount about organic waste and just walking around and seeing what was going on in New York City. The idea, you know, came to me, and so.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Ron Gonin, co-founder of Recycle Bank. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.